Welcome to the IPF edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the pulmonary fibrosis community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're here at the CHEST 2024 conference in Boston, and our guest today is Dr. Amy Case, a pulmonologist at Piedmont Healthcare in Atlanta. Dr. Case is also Chief Medical Officer at the Chicago-based Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation, the world's largest nonprofit organization dedicated to funding research and advocating for people with pulmonary fibrosis. Dr. Case, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the foundation.
Absolutely. So I am a pulmonary and critical care specialist at Piedmont Healthcare in Atlanta. I am actually an interstitial lung disease specialist, and I got involved in that subspecialty area of medicine really on the basis of a wonderful mentor that I was paired with in my fellowship training at UAB in Alabama. And Dr. Joao D'Andretti gave me so many opportunities to not only learn and interact with patients, but also participate in clinical trials and learn about how drug development happens in a rare disease space, in this case, pulmonary fibrosis. When I came out into practice with the intent to start an interstitial lung disease program at Piedmont, I utilized a lot of the research infrastructure that was already in place there. There's a lot of resources already available. We developed programs in interstitial lung disease. I also oversee pulmonary hypertension studies there too. And as I was building my program, what I found was that the Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation was a really incredible resource for myself, for my program, for my staff members, my nurses, and so on, as well as for the patients and caregivers. And I became involved very early with a support group that's housed at Piedmont. We brought additional educational programming and so on to the community as we were building our own program. And then later, when the opportunity came along to join the medical team at the Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation, I jumped at the opportunity to be able to work with an organization that I find does so much good work in this community and be able to give back just a little bit of what was given to me, my program, and my community.
How long have you been with the foundation?
So I joined the medical team about 4.5 years ago.
Okay. And you mentioned interstitial lung disease, and of course pulmonary fibrosis is one of the most common, if not the most common, type of ILD.
That is correct. So idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis is one of the more common types of interstitial lung disease, but there are over 200 different diagnoses that fall under that umbrella of interstitial lung disease that affect the, again, interstitium of the lungs, or the tissue of the lungs, and cause either inflammation or scarring or somewhere on the spectrum in between.
And to the best of your knowledge, how many patients in the United States have idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis?
So interstitial lung disease and pulmonary fibrosis affect somewhere over 200,000 patients in the United States. And as the patient population ages, more commonly they can develop pulmonary fibrosis. So we think that somewhere around 1 in 200 patients over the age of around 70 can be affected by some form of pulmonary fibrosis.
And you mentioned that in your studies you also worked with pulmonary hypertension.
Yes.
Which is another disease that we cover.
Oh, correct. Yeah. So I oversee a group, an advanced lung disease program at Piedmont Healthcare. I personally mostly take care of patients with interstitial lung disease, pulmonary fibrosis. I oversee the program and have work with three colleagues who specialize in the care of patients with pulmonary hypertension and also the clinical trials in PH.
So October 2nd, just a few weeks ago, was World Oxygen Day. And we understand that this day was used to kick off a campaign to call on Congress to pass what's known as the Supplemental Oxygen Access Reform, or SOAR Act, which seeks to ensure that people enrolled in Medicare who rely on supplemental oxygen can access the proper type and level of oxygen they need to live full, healthy lives. Why is this legislation so important?
Oh, it's so important. And honestly, the work towards the SOAR Act has been many years coming. There was a lot of emphasis around World Oxygen Day just to get the word out and get the community more activated. But there has been a coalition of different organizations, both professional organizations and patient advocacy organizations that have worked together, the Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation included, but I'll also call out the American Thoracic Society, the American Lung Association, the Pulmonary Hypertension Association, working towards legislation that will address some of the deficits in provision of supplemental oxygen to the patient population in the United States. One of the problems with accessing oxygen in the U.S. is that Medicare in particular uses a competitive bidding process to award contracts to medical equipment companies to provide oxygen for Medicare recipients.
And also people who are awaiting lung transplants.
Yes, that is also true. So many patients, patients awaiting lung transplants by definition will have advanced lung diseases, and the vast majority of them are reliant on supplemental oxygen to be able to live and function in preparation for their transplant.
And without this act, how are they managing?
You know, we get by. It's a lot of work on the patient and the caregiver. It's a lot of work on the physician, the office, the respiratory therapist that's managing those prescriptions. And oftentimes, in my experience, is that when I prescribe something to a patient, they don't always get what it is that I ask for them to get. And as particularly pulmonary fibrosis, as the needs of the patient increase, as their flow rates for oxygen increase, as they go from low flow oxygen to more high flow oxygen, the increase in need doesn't necessarily get reflected in what they're provided. And so
is this a money issue? Is that their needs obviously cost more the more progressive their disease?
So yes, the competitive bidding process caps out what will be reimbursed for a Medicare patient for a particular time period. And the medical equipment company that has that contract is obligated to provide the oxygen that the patient needs. But if they've run through the funding that they're getting reimbursed early on in that contract, then the DME company is still required to provide for the patient, but without getting reimbursed for even years beyond once they run out of funding. And it creates a situation where the DME, the overhead that's needed to support that patient, is not really being funded very well. And so they're trying to move to things that have lower overhead, that don't cost as much, and that kind of thing, and really doing sort of just the minimum of what's required to support the patient. And that's really unfortunate for people because they can't get the type of oxygen that they need. They can't get devices that work for them. And really, when it comes down to it, many people are limited by their need for supplemental oxygen when we really think that it should be something that facilitates them being more active and engaged in their lives. One thing we should talk about, I think, is the hollowing out of the infrastructure for something called liquid oxygen. Liquid oxygen is a really wonderful and elegant solution for people who need high flow oxygen. However, it is more expensive than something that is in a compressed gas tank, which is unfortunately very large and cumbersome for patients to use, or even while they're expensive, they actually aren't a renewed resource, something like a portable oxygen concentrator, which doesn't really deliver more than low flow oxygen. A liquid oxygen system can deliver high flows in a portable setting and allow people to get out and really engage in their lives in a way that truly is portable for those patients.
And from what I understand, these portable oxygen concentrators are also expensive. They're like $5,000 each.
They can be, absolutely. And the more oxygen they provide, the larger they are, right? And the more expensive that they can become. Some patients, you know, when they get frustrated with the options that might be available from their Medicare DME provider, might think about going and buying one out of pocket directly from an oxygen providing company. But what they run into in patients that have progressive diseases is that once you've bought that device, it's your device, and you're not renting it anymore, and nobody's obligated to then trade that device for something that meets your needs. This may meet your needs today, but it might not meet your needs a year from now or 2 years from now.
So you've been struggling with this legislation for years. Who's against it exactly?
That's a really good question. From my perspective, everybody breathes. We all are using oxygen all the time. And one can imagine, you know, how is it that anybody can be opposed to this type of thing when you see the needs of the patient and you see how they're struggling and you hear from them directly? And in my experience, talking with legislators, talking with my own representative's office, talking with my own senator staff, they see, and when they hear from patients, it really does hit home. They want their constituents to have access to all the things, particularly the things that they need to live their full and best lives. I think where the rubber meets the road is back to the cost of care and overall the cost potentially of the Medicare program, and that there are folks out there in positions to make the laws that that are doing their best to try and be judicious about the money that's spent and balance, you know, try to balance budgets as much as possible. But the idea of the SOAR Act is not to do away with competitive bidding altogether, which competitive bidding affects a lot of other things that make a bit more sense to have under that umbrella. But it carves out all types of supplemental oxygen, so they're not in that process anymore, and create a separate pay structure that actually does make sense and covers the care that patients are getting, and hopefully enables the rebuilding of some of the liquid oxygen infrastructure and provides a little bit more for support for these patients that are living with supplemental oxygen in their lives.
Okay, that makes sense. Can you identify by name any member of Congress who's in your corner going to bat for you in Capitol Hill?
Sure. Actually, this is a bipartisan act. It is bicameral, so it was introduced in the Senate first by both Senator Bill Cassidy and Senator Mark Warner. Senator Cassidy is actually a physician, and so he's in a wonderful position to advocate for the needs of patients. Shortly thereafter, it was introduced in the House, and in both houses of Congress, it does have bipartisan support, and we are slowly getting out with our patient population, our advocates, our caregivers, all of these different organizations, some of which I mentioned earlier, and really reaching out to those elected officials, talking to them about the importance of this. I think when we talk to them again, nobody says, wow, oxygen just really isn't a priority for us. They understand, they see the need, and they're inclined to sort of look into it and try to understand it a little bit more. I encourage them to look into it, to understand the ramifications of it, and really make a well-informed decision about whether to co-sponsor and support.
Great. So in the little time we have left, I want to move on to another topic. Pulmonary fibrosis, of course, is considered a rare disease, as is pulmonary hypertension. According to FDA guidelines, anything that affects fewer than 200,000 Americans is still a rare disease. Yet, as you pointed out earlier in our conversation, it's been exactly 10 years since any new antifibrotic therapies have been approved by the FDA. What is your organization doing to try to spur that along?
That's a great question. It has been a long time, and it's not for lack of effort, right? There have been clinical trials, things that have looked very promising in phase one, in phase two studies that have gotten to the point of phase three studies and not actually worked out when they've been tested in a larger population, particularly in idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, which is where the most development has been, but also in the development for other types of progressive pulmonary fibrosis. And the Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation supports research in a couple of different ways. One, we have a patient registry that contains a lot of information about patients living with pulmonary fibrosis that's very well characterized and has associated biobanked blood samples, imaging that researchers can propose projects to query that data and information to try to understand disease state a bit better. We also have our community registry, which is open for anybody to self-enroll and start sharing their own experience and information from their own home. So you don't have to be affiliated with a center or a particular site. You can do this on your own. And it's open for not just patients, but also caregivers and family members, as well as people who have received lung transplants for pulmonary fibrosis diagnoses. We also have a scholars program where we fund early career investigators who are starting out their careers in pulmonary fibrosis and studying in our disease space. These are basic translational as well as clinical projects that then have a very high success rate of going on to more awards, particularly with the NIH funding and NHLBI. And we have a clinical trial platform where we provide education about clinical trials, information about ongoing clinical trials in multiple types of formats. We have a clinical trial finder where people can go and submit their own information and find out what trials might be available for them particularly, and ways in which you can just learn more broadly about the different clinical trial opportunities.
Wonderful. We're just about out of time. I want to appreciate you saying thank you for speaking with us today. We've been talking with Dr. Amy Case, pulmonologist at Piedmont Healthcare in Atlanta and chief medical officer at the Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.